Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 58 of the Dad's Army podcast. Now, I'm going to have to start this show with an apology. Regular listeners to the podcast will be expecting a trial. Yes, a trial of Lance Corporal Jack Jones. And I'm afraid that's not going to happen this episode. Now, as we've mentioned in the past, this particular episode is taking a lot of planning. And I think both Oliver and I are being quite diligent in building compelling cases. In Oliver's case, for the defence, and in my case, for the prosecution. So I'm afraid that we haven't quite got as much evidence as we need to give Jack Jones a fair trial. So I do apologise for the additional delay to that episode. However, what we've got instead is a featured episode discussion. Now, we haven't just sat and reviewed an episode of Dad's Army for what must be nearly a year or so now. So what's coming up is a chat that Paul Carpenter of the Dad's Army Appreciation Society and I had coming up to a year or so ago now, talking all about Command Decision, the third episode of Dad's Army to be broadcast ever. So I hope that makes up for the absence of the Jones episode. Oliver and I are hoping to record the Jones episode very soon, so hopefully it should be out towards the end of March at the absolute latest. And my second apology is for the sound quality in the last two Dad's Army podcasts. It was a technical hitch. Oliver and I recorded them back to back, so we didn't detect it, I'm afraid, until I came to edit it. I managed to clean it up the best I possibly could, and I do think it's listenable, but hopefully this particular podcast will be free of any unwanted underwater effect. Anyway, the only thing I've got left to say before we get into discussing Command Decision is don't forget the competition we launched a couple of podcasts ago, and that was to win a copy of Season 1 and 2 of Dad's Army on DVD just by identifying two clips from episodes within those two series. Now, I know most of you out there will have these episodes on DVD or VHS or in some other format already. However, consider this. If you do win this competition, you can spread the love of Dad's Army by giving someone the first two series on DVD. Look at it that way. And you can probably gather, we've had very, very few entries. If you are interested in becoming the proud owner Series 1 and 2 on DVD, even if it's for the second time, and you submit your entry, then you stand a very good chance of winning. The odds are in your favour at the time of recording. The email address for competition entries is james@dadsarmypodcast.com.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run?
Knife, cosh, knuckle duster, bicycle chain, sandwiches.
Do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?
A touch of indigestion, sir.
Yes, just a touch of veterans.
Yes, well, perhaps you'd they have one of these, sir. Sometimes they're quite helpful, you never know.
Thank you. Yeah. Calm Tom. So, for all tummy disorders, also combats air raid strain. What's air raid strain got to do with tummy?
This gun, so who do you think?
Decision. That was only the third episode of Dad's Army ever, and I have to say I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm here to discuss that episode with Paul Carpenter. Hello, Paul.
Hello, James.
This podcast is always sadly devoid of any kind of pinpoint, precise accuracy when you're not on it. Let's talk about Command Decision then. What are your first thoughts on Command Decision?
Well, I hadn't seen it for a while, like yourself, and I hadn't realised how such a good episode it is, really. Mm. I think we both mentioned when we were discussing how pivotal it is, another pivotal episode, because right at the very end, I know I'm jumping to the end, right at the very end, the actual LDV then changes to Home Guard. So after Command Decision, we are talking Home Guard.
Mm. Let's go right back to the top of the episode. And of course, throughout the whole of Series 2, you had some newsreel again, same as you had in Series 1, except they seem to be slightly more fictional or recorded parts featuring the platoon in these kind of newsreels.
Well, what I think this does, certainly now, it saves going back over old ground or reviewing what's happened before. Once you see the newsreel, you know exactly it's the Home Guard and you're in straight into the episode bank. There's no need to go back over old ground again. Mm. And that's done quite well. And I think certainly in this first series, they didn't need to do it for the whole of the episode for the first series, certainly, but the few earlier ones, it does work really well.
Hmm. Now, I think this montage right at the beginning had a couple of location scenes
in it. They didn't look immediately like Thetford.
They weren't. No, the couple, the one where they're doing with a motorbike, that's done on in Thetford, that's done on the Stantouf training area. But the one with the railings and the block of flats, that's actually Richmond Green.
In London?
In London.
Yeah. Wow.
And I suspect that was filmed at the same time they did the Charlie Cheeseman.
That's Shooting Pains.
Shooting Pains, or they were rehearsing. Might have been Shooting Pains. Yeah, sorry, yeah, Shooting Pains. They filmed Shooting Pains in the theatre at Richmond, and I suspect they used the opportunity to film a bit of external there.
Was that the only time that you know that they filmed in London?
Yes. The bomb they used in...
Something Nasty in the Vault.
is on display in Richmond Museum. They borrowed it, apparently, for the episode. Yeah.
Is there a little placard?
I haven't had time to go and have a look, to be honest, but yes.
Well, Richmond's not too far away from where I live, so I'll have to go and have a look at some point.
I was doing some research, I had a hint. Because they filmed at Richmond Theatre, I thought, well, while I'm here, there are certain location shots that we weren't sure of for that first series. So I thought I'd look around and walked around the green, and flats were there. And it was a good find, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll have to show me that at some point. I'll be quite keen on seeing it. Going back to the episode then, we've got the opening parade. It's not the opening scene.
It's the parade setting, obviously. Most episodes, a majority of episodes started off with a parade, didn't they?
They did. I mean, there's probably a technical name for it, but this scene is split into two, really. You've got the parade to start with, and then the lecture or debacle that was the unarmed combat sketch. Which I did really enjoy. But I think Wilson seemed to be quite authoritative in the opening parade ground, much more so than he was later on, really.
Not so vague, I think. Obviously, it's the character still developing, and I think you found that certainly when you read the strips, Wilson is much more authoritative on the bits they've missed out. Mm. And some occasions, I think I mentioned before, where he actually... not quite has a go at Mannering, but stands his ground against Mannering. But that, obviously, the development of the character was more in line with John Misura himself, I think.
Yeah, he becomes much more subservient later on, and there's only one line that I can think of where he stands up to Mannering, and that's in War Dance.
Oh, right, yes.
Yes. Anyway, there's an exchange between Jones and Walker in this episode where Jones says that Walker is registered with Jones for meets, and of course by the armoured might of Lance Corporal Jones, Walker has taken his business elsewhere, because it's made clear he's not registered.
He might just not been registered at all.
No, but maybe that's what it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, Frank Scarfe. There's some discussion over Frank's muffler, and it's not the Aston Villa scarf yet, and it's certainly not the same one that's in the closing credits, and it's not the same one that's in the closing credits in colour, which is blue, I believe, which was just a towel, it wasn't a scarf.
No, I only heard that recently, actually.
So the actual Frank scarf hadn't appeared. We don't know what colour it is, because it's in black and white. You should know, wouldn't it? I'll dig out, see if I find a colour photograph taken at the time.
Is that the first time they make a joke out of Pike's scarf?
I'm not sure, because his mother certainly comes in the first episode.
But I'm not sure whether she refers directly to the scarf.
Catch a cold? Not sure. Maybe she does.
Could be. One thing I did want to ask you about is just at the end of the parade ground, Marion says, on the command move, do such and such.
Move, I think.
But he never actually gives.
No, no one gives the command move. Even I think it's just one of those things, on the command move. I don't know what they do. They just move into a different position, don't they?
That was it. It was like,
don't
okay,
even gather around, do they?
No, I found that quite interesting.
I like the bit that's revealed when they actually start playing with a knife. You're talking, it must have been an accident happened with playing with a knife before. And it's revealed you can actually see Mannering's bandage on his hand. Whereas the scenes before that, when he's inspecting, he inspects Jones, Walker, and, he does them all, doesn't he? Phrase at the end. You never see his hand, do you? It's only revealed when he's playing with a knife that he's actually got his hand bandaged up.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's a good visual joke. And it's not what the series used a little bit more in future episodes, which was in-your-face slapstick stuff. This is actually carefully thought out. Yeah, subtle visual comedy. And I like that.
Unfortunately, it does disappear later on when it's in the bank. It's obviously secured quite quickly. But no, it's nice. It was a nice reveal, and that's the enjoyable part about it, really.
Well, I'm going to say something that will probably be quite a surprise to you, but I really like Jones in this episode, and I began to remember that I liked Clive Dunn's portrayal again, specifically within this episode, as I was rewatching it. And I only think I've seen this episode probably three times in my life ever. And when he was coming up with a speech about being, you know, my morale is shattered, it was strange for me because I was much more familiar with the radio version, because I was very familiar with the radio version of Command Decision long before I saw the TV version. And Clive Dunn plays it very differently in the two versions.
Touching. It's quite a touching exchange between Mannering and Jones in the office there. And also, he does make a commitment to Jones. And I can't remember, they shake hands? I can't remember now, but they do something. And it's quite touching.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I mean, that office scene between all three of them, I mean, I think had a scene like that where they had to portray a breakdown come up in an episode in season 6, 7,
it would have been
much more.
Wouldn't work. I don't think it would work. Jones later on is more the clown.
Yeah.
And certainly in the first series, doesn't do any of this slapstick that you don't like. I think you probably like the character of Jones isn't a problem for you. I just think you don't believe the fact that an old person of whatever age you're supposed to be, 80 odd, would do those sort of things, jumping about and being stupid and reacting the way he did.
I like the way that he was portrayed pretty much in season 1 and 2. Towards the end of season 2, where, you know, Operation Kilts, I don't know if that was towards the end actually, but that's where you got into the slightly silly storylines for the first time, really. And I just really enjoyed Clive Dunn's portrayal this time. He had genuinely touching moments with Wilson and Mannering. And Mannering, again, that last line in the office scene was "the hour and the man."
Mm.
You know, that's not a comedy or a comedic line. I don't know whether it was supposed to be.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was. It's just a quote, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and obviously it's inverts the man and the hour. And it's made me a little bit more intrigued now, having watched it again today. I want to go and look up where that actually is from. Not something you're aware of by any chance?
Sounds like a Churchill thing to me.
Maybe that's actually, I'd lay money on it, even though without...
I should know, really.
Yeah. Interesting.
I do like that little bit in the office is nice. It's unusual for Mannering to make a commitment at this stage, and he didn't know which way it was going, but obviously the audience doesn't know how it's going to end up and how he actually gets to it at that time. And we're talking of Mannering as well, certainly in this series, and Mannering and Wilson, the way they're dressed. Mannering is wearing a check shirt and a tweed jacket. Wilson's wearing a sort of tweed jacket and a shirt, and Mannering's wearing his tie. You never see him dressed that way again after, certainly once they get the uniforms. And at any time you see Mannering not in uniform, he's either in his bank get-up with a black jacket and white shirt.
What about the movie?
Well, that's the first series, isn't it? That's sort of based on that. And I think that's when they're in civvies. That's when he's in his civvies. And once they get the uniform in the film, he's in uniform for the rest of it, isn't he?
Yeah.
But I think the film is probably based on the first series, certainly.
Interesting.
The way he's dressed with the cap and the check shirt. And the film's quite early on in the series, isn't it?
It's,
and certainly later on, you never see him in his off how he was dressed to work in the garden or whatever he did.
Yes. I think Mannering comes across as a real leader here. And, you know, you think he's got a little empire within his bank and his day job. But what's that? 5 or 6 staff, I think we're supposed to believe, I think. Maybe 5 or 6 staff.
A few. So you don't see Pike in the bank, I don't think. And during this, certainly in this episode, he's not there. But we do see a soft side to Mannering where he actually lets that person have his loan. And
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he's not the hard man. The character is slightly different, as we said before, but everyone's developing. And it's a shame that part of him wasn't carried through, because it would, I think people would more sort of be in touch with him a bit more, certainly. He's human. He's not this blustering, stupid bank manager come home guard captain. He's a person with feelings, and part of his job is dealing with the public. And And then here we have it. He's helped one of his customers out. He understands the problem. Somebody's a hoarder to reckon about the Seafrig line, obviously. Yes. And obviously it doesn't... Historically, if you didn't know what happened, it probably wouldn't mean much to you, but, you know, knowing what happened, and of course, if you're singing about a disaster, the Seafrig line disappeared, obviously, and people wouldn't buy a record about that, wouldn't they?
I think it shows much more of a... I don't want to use the word developed character, because that implies that he lost a lot of what made him an interesting character later on. And of course we know that the caricature of Mannerin almost was what ingrained itself into the public consciousness. And even today, you know, when people do refer to Mannerin in contemporary news and satirical comedy shows, it's not a rounded man, you know, it's about this pompous man.
No, I think,
and I think that's a shame.
When they refer to the Mannerin character, really they're referring to Square. He is more like the character that people refer to as Mannerin.
Yeah, and I agree. I think Mannerin and Square have got a lot in common, and I think we talked about this when we talked about Don't Forget the Diver over a year ago. And I still think that the reason they don't get on so much is because Square is a more overt version of what Mannerin became later on. But that's a nice little segue, actually, straight into the scene that introduces a character who is seen throughout Dad's Army all the way up to Series 9.
Yeah, he's a character, and he doesn't change at all. That character is set in stone, blustery, no-nonsense, arm in charge.
Absolutely.
Captain Square, sort of, right, put me in charge, what are you going to do, you know? Manny's not having any of it, is he? He says empire. He's not going to step down from. He's the captain. Doesn't need another captain. Square wants to take control, and but the end uses that little thing about, well, I'll take my rifles elsewhere then.
Oh, and clearly Eastgate accepted the bribe because he ended up as captain of Eastgate, didn't he? And he said, "Oh, I'll take them to Eastgate then."
Took him on in the end.
I think the introduction of Captain Square is one of the best introductory scenes for an additional character in Dad's Army that we ever see, because that current bun scene and the fly swat.
Oh yes, that's good. Yes.
Every time, nice Paul, thing. Every nice time thing. I laugh at that, and I've only seen it three times.
And you can't see it coming, can you? No. The fact that there is a bun joke later on, I think, in when they go to Marigold Tea Rooms, they swap buns around. And it would be Wilson that has all the fruit, and Mannering has nothing. That's yes. Mannering all over, isn't it? But yeah, nice little touch there, and you don't see it coming. He's lost a raisin, so what? Yeah, but then again, it does reappear, and that's good comedy.
It was. Good it comedy was very writing. Good. Yeah. Very, very good. And
the misunderstanding that goes with it. What do you do with them? Well, you don't want to waste them, do you?
And the funny thing is, it's never actually resolved, and Dad's Army isn't usually that, you know, subtle in as much as it leaves a joke unfinished. You know, we go back and revisit it and say, well, actually, it's a carrot, not a fly. But that line is never uttered.
It does show, because your previous guest, you're talking about the Man on the Hour.
Oh, yeah.
Who wasn't not a Dad's Army fan, and obviously seen it probably for the first time. I can't remember. Had he seen it for the first
I think
time?
He had seen it before, but
not studied it as such.
Not as much as you or I would have.
But he noted and commented on the fact that it shows a maturity in writing, certainly for the first episode, and this, even though it's the third episode of the series, does show some maturity, whether it's partly because David Cropp was an experienced producer at the time and brought something to it as well, but certainly Jimmy Perry, I expect, is behind certainly the first series, even the structure and the ideas we brought to David Croft. But it does, yeah, it's good writing.
Very confident indeed. I think that comes across through probably the casting of Geoffrey Lumsden, because he plays that character absolutely convincingly, and as you say, it doesn't change over the 9-year run.
Now, you mentioned Captain Square.
I was just about to mention him again.
Character. Yeah. Now, who else appeared in the character that was constant right the way through to the end?
Okay. I would like to say I know the answer when you tell me.
We're talking about... You won't know his name, Charles Hill.
I remember him in the credits. Why don't I remember him?
Because Charles Hill was the butler.
Oh, thank you, yes. And Wake Up Warmington.
Yeah, Wake Up Warmington Parkins. His name wasn't actually referred to by name, but he has, throughout the series, he cropped up a few times. rotten sergeant, excellent butler.
I remember.
And but he's the same character, same person played him all the way through, right away to the end. And that's really, really, really good that you see the same person. It's so easy to change the butler just because he only appeared a few times. But to bring the same person back again as his butler, right away through to wake up Warmington, he's the same person.
But is he working for somebody else in Wake Up Warmington, though, rather than Captain Square?
Captain Square, he's a butler, but not Square's butler.
That's what I wanted, because otherwise that would imply that they're in Square's, well, Marsham Hall, presumably.
Yeah, Marsham Hall.
Yeah, interesting.
Mm.
No, you're right, I did recognise him. It just slipped my mind in the few hours since I've seen it. Captain Square does remind me very much of another character in another sitcom as well, and he doesn't look like him in any way, shape or form, but he's very similar to Stephen Fry's General in Blackadder. Milchett, that's it, yes.
Because Ben Elton is a huge Dad's Army fan.
He is, yeah.
And I wouldn't put it past him. Thin Blue Line.
He's Dad's Army, essentially.
Dad's Army,
yeah.
Brought up to date, almost. So, yeah, people's influences come from everywhere, and yeah, you might be right. Mm-hmm. Very, very similar, even though he was dressed almost. Yes. With a bit of a stash and everything.
I suppose so. I hadn't thought of that. I suppose that's a kind of stereotypical view of a military officer.
A blimp.
Yes. Very, blimp. Very good. Yeah, with a Colonel Blimp mentality. Yes. This episode also saw some cutting special effects, didn't it?
I wouldn't say cutting. I suppose cutting is the effect that they cut it and just rewind the tape again.
I suppose so.
Pretty basic special effects. Oh, okay, it was not my favourite part of the episode, I must admit. And it's a bit obvious. I mean, a child could see what was going on. And they probably didn't need to do that because they were real circus horses, as evident by the fact that one was lying down and the way they were reacting. They probably could have done it without having to resort to trickery in the cutting room. And it was nice to reveal again the fact they are circus horses, which is why he's got them, but obviously not the one that Square was riding. Now, I don't think it might have been Geoffrey Lumsden riding the horse. Certainly difficult to tell because so poor, isn't it, the actual quality of the filming.
Yeah.
But I did notice that Richard Jakes, one of the background platoon men, was riding one of them, certainly going under the branch where Jonesy was.
Yeah.
You could pick him out.
I did wonder how many of the actors actually rode the horses.
John Laurie probably did. Certainly John Laurie rode a horse in the 2½ feathers and probably a Soldier's Farewell, where most of them were on horseback. And Arthur Lowe was a good horseman as well, but we don't see him on the horse, do we?
Of course not.
During that one. And John Misere wasn't mounted at all.
Yeah.
There was some bad editing when they bring the horses out the stables, which was filmed at Buckingham Tofts on Stanton. And actually, that block is exactly the same, hasn't changed.
I've been there.
You've been there. Well, part of the building had demolished at the end, but certainly the stable area has gone. But the editing where the shadow was moving quite quickly, that's a shame.
Yeah.
But that's one of those things you, at the time, no videos, no one would pick up on.
So absolutely.
I was going to jump back a bit to the hall where you've got Walker offering all these guns, courtesy of the IRA, no less. and it's one, I know it's only been shown about 4 times this episode, but another episode, Absent Friends, where they mentioned the IRA, was not shown again because of the mention. So, strange that this one did get shown and has been shown since. And
did they
cut it? The IRA was mentioned. Certainly Star Trek had mentioned IRA a few times and those episodes were never shown.
Right. That's really interesting. I mean, I think, personally, it's a little bit neurotic.
And another thing that dates it, obviously, in the background, when they're in the hall, all the platoon in the background, you know, it's all smoking away. And good reactions, because as reviewing the episode, I look at what's going on in the back as well.
Yeah, excellent.
Why they're all talking, they're all laughing and to what's going on. And it's quite closely cropped as well. Later on, they would have panned back and seen the whole platoon lined up, but the way it was filmed, quite close, but you still able to see everyone in the background.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
I just think everything within context. I mean, you're right, I don't think we would see, you know, a whole load of people smoking these days. But having said that, EastEnders do quite frequently.
Mm.
Not as much as they used to, admittedly, but they do. And I think any kind of controversial mention of any organisation or any kind of socially unacceptable habit... smoking, everything within context if it's out of context and it's, you know, it sticks out a mile purely to get a cheap laugh, then yeah, okay, I would agree that it shouldn't feature. But there's nothing in Dad's Army that I would say, you know, that applies to. And certainly not this line. But, you know, there you go. I mean, I know people are sensitive about certain things.
Also, Bailey's Circus.
Yep.
Names do recur in Croft and Perry. Now, we had Captain Bailey, who'd disappeared by then, I think. He wasn't anywhere to be seen, certainly by now. He was in the first, certainly the first episode. And the name cropped up again. And of course, Captain Bailey did reappear later on.
John Ringham's character, wasn't it? Was he Captain Bailey?
In Room at the Bottom.
And then we get into the last scene, which is the office scene with Mannering. He's given up and he's almost going to hand over to Captain Square at this stage. And then in comes, I don't know what grade he is, but he's played by Gordon Peters, who does reoccur in Dad's Army several times. Certainly, yeah, part of a fireman in the first episode was put on the cutting room floor. And I think this is a feedback to that, David Croft giving him some extra parts.
Mm.
He comes in, hands over 500 armbands with LDV, just after they've been renamed the Home Guard.
Yes.
And a lovely bit here about the signatures. Fantastic. I mean, I don't know about you, but he gets in the sign here, and there, and the third. And you always think that's it, the third one. And there's a fourth as well.
Over the
fantastic
page.
No, four signatures, and you think three. Normally, jokes are done in threes, aren't they?
That's very true, actually.
But yep. they have the confidence to add a fourth to that. It gets another laugh, doesn't it?
Oh, it did. And Mannering's reaction. This is ridiculous.
A fourth signature. Now, your listeners, go and look at that last scene again, and tell me that it's not funny.
Yeah.
There were four signatures there.
Is that replicated in Big Guns? Where it's the sign for the Pickfords, the Pickford man's
it's
chitty.
It's all Beatles again, isn't it?
It's yes, and it's also Don Estelle, that's it. I was just about to call him Gerald.
No, he wasn't Gerald then. He came back. He obviously got a job in the ARP.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough. Yes.
But it's similar. Not identical, but it's similar.
It is similar, yes, but we don't get the build up to the scene and the Gordon Peters deadpan delivery of it. And of course, in the office, we have the five rifles, I think I counted correctly.
Yeah, there are.
And that's quite moving, the way he hides them from Wilson when he comes in, because his first reaction is to hide them from Wilson because he wasn't sure what he was going to do then, was he? Almost taken aback by these rifles coming in. A nice ending to it as well, and I think he deserved it as well. And he made a commitment, and at the end of the episode, he gives it. And that's just, I think from the command decision, things do change, certainly for the Home Guard, as it was going to be called from then. A new page is turned, and they go forward, I think.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed this particular episode again, and it was quite surprising because I hadn't dug it out of its DVD box for some time. I thoroughly enjoyed The Enemy Within the Gates, and that's one that I have seen many, many times, and of course that's the one directly after Command Decision.
Yeah, because there's a lot going on. It's got about five different sections to it, and each section's well structured.
Yep.
Very entertaining. Quite funny, bit and touching as well, and we've touched on that before, the fact that the writing can change moods quite quickly. We have two touching bits, which is one with Jones, and then quite at the end as well, when he's about to give up. So, all in all, am I going to vote it? Are we going to give points to it?
Absolutely,
I'm going to give it a 4.5, because I wouldn't have given it a 4.5 hadn't I gone back and looked at it again. I think talking through it with yourself and looking at the episode in a different light, I think, yes, that stands up on its own. It's a very good episode. There's lovely bits in there with the fly, with the signatures. We haven't mentioned Miss Samways and Miss Beckwith, two names that do reappear again. Bit of continuity, not known for its continuity.
I think I'm going to lead up to it a little bit first, though. I think
here we go, listeners.
I think it's got really, really good moments that are very different from each other. You know, you can view one episode and say this is brilliant because it's so funny in so many different places. Well, this one, It twanged the emotional chord, certainly with Jones in the office. Thoroughly enjoyed that. It made me laugh out loud with the current bun scene.
Yes,
I agree. I think it's pivotal because there are a couple of firsts there. You got the very first time you see Captain Square introduced, and you got the very first time that the platoon are referred to as the Home Guard.
Certainly, yeah.
And ultimately, I just thought it was really good. It was much better than I remembered it. There's no question of
and
that.
And I think...
No, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Well done.
I don't think it's the best one, but I will now revisit it periodically, whereas it just hasn't occurred to me to do that. And I'm grateful to the episode for doing that, really. Mm. And I think perhaps I'm going to have to start looking at some other episodes that I don't automatically think, oh, I'd like to see that now. Okay, Paul, just like to say thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for letting me look at that episode again. And I've come away, enjoying it even more, I think. Great stuff.
Wonderful.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion. As I said at the top of the show, it's been a long time since we've just sat and talked about an episode of Dad's Army. And just listening to that recording again made me realise that we really ought to do that a little bit more frequently, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to record, and it was fun listening to, given it's been nearly a year or so since we made that recording. Don't forget to send us your feedback. As always, that's james@dadsarmypodcast.com or oliver@dadsarmypodcast.com. Oliver will be back on the next edition of the Dad's Army Podcast, where we will get round to talking about everybody's favourite Lance Corporal. In the meantime, thanks very much indeed for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll speak to you again very soon. Bye for now.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler? If you think we're on the run.
Knife, cosh, knuckle duster, bicycle chain, sandwiches.
A touch of indigestion, sir.
Yes, just a touch of flatulence.
Yes, well, perhaps you'd... they have one of these, sir. Sometimes they're quite helpful, you never know.
Thank you. Yes. Calm Tums. Oh, okay. For all tummy disorders, also combats air raid strain. What's air raid strain got to do with tummy? This gun, so who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?